Welcome to Soundbites on Domrava. I'm your host, Mark Steiner. In the past year, we've brought you stories about the land, the farms, and the people of Domrava. Throughout the year, it became clear to us that our listeners want to see the rural character of Domrava survive. So we began to look deeper into certain questions. What will it take to keep farmers on their land? Is it possible to tend to the health of the environment and also to the needs of the people of our state and our nation? We will explore how farms, both urban and rural, can feed and employ our people, how we can get fresh produce to our citizens, how we can take care of the environment, and how we can create a 21st century food system that is more just and healthier for each of us and our world. We believe it can be done. Please join us as we explore how we can get there together. Many people say that small, sustainable farms can only serve a small niche market. But the folks at Red Tomato see a different world of possibilities. So this week on Soundbites, we speak with members of Red Tomato, a nonprofit business that is a food hub connecting wholesale growers to supermarkets and other retailers located throughout the Northeast. They coordinate marketing, sales, and logistics for over 40 family farms and have been working at this for over 16 years. I interviewed Director of Operations, Angel Mendez, Director of Resource Development, Laura Edwards Orr, and Executive Director and Founder, Michael Rosine. Michael, Angel, and Laura, welcome. Good to have the three of you with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
See, even the introductions sounded complex. So, to start with, Michael, take us back to the beginning of Red Tomato and what you helped found and why, and maybe a little bit about how it changed.
Red Tomato was born inside of Equal Exchange, the worker-owned cooperative fair trade company. All along, for all of those dozen years, I was kind of missing working on the home front with local farmers. And so I took a sabbatical and asked myself, well, what would this fair trade economics look like if we were doing it right here in this part of the United States, working with local fruit and vegetable growers? I'm a hobby grower, not a commercial grower, but it's what I love most. And so answering that question led to the start of Red Tomato back in 1996. And what we have turned into is a region-wide network of medium-sized fruit and vegetable growers, and we have found that the place we can make the biggest difference is by creating a distribution system that connects those growers and the retail supermarket world. And so here we are 16 years later, and we're still refining the model.
I mean, and that to me was fascinating when I first heard the story, because this is not just connecting to farmers' markets. You're talking about retail operations, regional grocery store chains that sell the products of local farmers.
Yes. And, you know, one of the observations that we've made over time is just that there's so many elements that will be necessary to really change or transform the regional food system. But we're doing a piece of it that many of our kind of sister organizations don't work on or don't want to be part of. And I bet Laura can fill out that picture a little bit.
Well, go ahead, Laura, please.
Sure. The kind of challenges for small and mid-sized growers, and that's the parallel to this dynamic between the farmer's markets and supplying a grocery store. So we see a lot of success with farmers that are supplying to farmer's markets and a lot of very vibrant consumer demand and activism around food access and increasing systems to get more farmer's markets into cities and more consumers there and a wider access. What's more challenging is those mid-sized farms that you called out that are too big to just focus on those direct markets like a farmer's market or a CSA. Many of them are multi-generational farms. They can be larger in scale, you know, 100, 200 acres, and they need a bigger, more diverse market to keep that family business afloat. And so those are the farms that have the capacity and the know-how to supply a regional grocery store chain and to really bring local food into those mainstream markets at a much wider scale than we could through direct markets, which has been a very significant driver of the local foods movement, kind of the, one of the very first places people meet a farmer and start to learn about their food system is at the farmer's market,
mm-hmm.
where we can step in with connecting those mid-sized growers to the grocery store is kind of the next layer of reinforcement for those consumers who have bought into this idea of a local food system.
I mean, one of the things that kind of excited me as I was reading about the work that you all do is what you're describing, Laura, in just in terms of figuring out a way that allows farmers to survive and grow, become remain economically viable, and having their produce, in this case, feed a much larger population than
mm-hmm.
they would with just the limitations of farmers markets and CSAs.
Right, right. So our Red Tomato's core purpose is about creating opportunities for our growers to become primary suppliers of a regional sustainable food system. So that's a pretty jam-packed sentence. But what it means is we want those mid-sized growers to have the opportunity to be the supplier of an apple or a summer squash when it's in season. And so we recognize that New England has a different it doesn't have a year-round growing season, so we're not saying, you know, we need New England summer squash in February. But when those products are in season in the region, those growers should have an opportunity to bring those products to market.
And one of the things I understand, Angel, that makes this also different is you don't, some people in Baltimore and other cities I've talked to are attempting to kind of create a central distribution point, a warehouse. But you're approaching things at Red Tomato in a very different way.
Yeah. And we don't have a centralized place where we're packing things. We're all of the packing of fruit and vegetables is being done at farms. And so the reason for that is that the cost that it takes to run a warehouse, to run coolers, to run trucks and truckers and all of that stuff has proven to us to be way too expensive for us to operate that way. So we've changed our business model to still work hard on differentiating the commodities and adding values to the produce items that we're selling. What we're doing in this model is that in 2002 when I came to Red Tomato, we had our own trucks, we had our warehouse, and we were picking up product and shipping it all from our centralized location in Canton, Mass. After a year of operating that way, we seen that the cost involved in operating in that way were way too expensive and wasn't a sustainable model for us to operate. So we moved our model to having the product packed at farms. We work with an art designer in South Carolina who designs the artwork for us, and we work with them on capturing all of the good practices that our growers do at the point of sale to consumers. And so we have everything packed at farms, and we coordinate the logistics and distribution and handle all of the bookkeeping, et cetera.
So that means, Laura, that the farmers who work with you, and we'll get into something more about that in a minute, they don't, the food is not labeled as that farm's label. It's Red Tomato. Is that right?
Well, actually,
or am I wrong?
We work really hard to bring both. Uh-huh. We work really hard to bring the farm name to the consumer because we know, just like at the farmer's market, the magic happens when a consumer has a really strong idea of where their food comes from. The farm name has a lot of value. So our apple tote bags are a really good example of how we're co-branding with the farms that we work with. So if you can picture a paper apple tote, it's got some artwork on the front and the back, and on one side panel it has Red Tomato story. On the other side panel, it has the farm story. And underneath the Eco Apple label is the name of the farm, front and center. So we are most often co-branding with the grower to maintain that farmer ID right up through the point of purchase.
So, Michael, I'm going to take a kind of a question beyond where we are at the moment in 2012 with what you're doing and what the possibilities are, and ask for a moment if we just kind of jump into what you think this could mean. People are wrestling with all over the country, whether it's here where we're broadcasting from in the Delmarva region, Delaware, Maryland, Virginia, southern Pennsylvania, Washington, D.C., about how is it viable to create a regional system that actually small farmers can grow and sell their products, and whether it's viable or not. And so what tell me about this model in terms of how you extrapolate this model out and what it might mean for the future of food and farming in America.
Well, I can hear some of my colleagues shouting in my ear, talk about fossil fuels. So,
okay.
For many, there's a resounding yes to your question, and behind that would be an expectation that fossil fuels are going to keep on getting more expensive and being challenged in all kinds of ways, which forces the closer is better view of the world. But I think an equally profound kind of subground to your question is about money and cost of food when you talk about viability.
Mm-hmm.
So we spent 50 years moving small loads and small farms out of mainstream distribution and replacing them with tractor trailer-sized truck loads and boat loads of product that are coming increasingly far, to the point now where those who can command year-round supply are the strongest competitors in the food system, and they're mostly shipping large quantities long distances. And long distances can mean thousands of miles, or it could even mean 5,000 to 10,000 miles, as in the case of Chilean and New Zealand and Israeli and Chinese products. So how does this all fit together? I think that we are seeing a surge of grassroots, small-scale innovations that are trying to answer your question, trying to prove that a region can increasingly provide solutions, excellent quality stuff, brought in under the best of conditions and made available at affordable prices. And what the food hub craze is really focusing on is that very question. Can the local food movement be scaled up so that the market share it's providing really begins to matter? When we work with medium-sized farms, one of the great challenges is moving small quantities of food around. We enter the marketplace and we try to have a competitive offer to a supermarket chain, and a lot of times what they're looking at is another supplier who has access to year-round product that might move, let's say, from Northern California all the way down the coast into parts of Mexico, or it could be a southeastern United States, but they've basically got 6 to 9 months of supply that they can provide, and they're moving it in full tractor trailer loads. Now we come to the Northeast, and we try to go up against that and offer something that will satisfy the supermarket chain and essentially take the place of that substitute for that long-distance product. One of the biggest problems is how do you move one or two pallets of product from a farm to a supermarket warehouse at a competitive freight rate? And sometimes it costs as much or more to move 50 to 100, 150 boxes from a couple hundred miles could cost more than moving 1,000 boxes 3,000 miles. And that's an example of what keeps Angel awake all night. That's the kind of problem that Angel and his team are trying to work on all day during the growing season.
So, Angel, how does that work?
Well, it's tricky because it all depends on the truck that you're on. It all depends on the truck that you're hiring and what lanes the truck that you're able to connect with and what lanes they're currently running. So if, for example, there's kiwi berries up in Danville, Pennsylvania that I'm able to bring down from Danville, Pennsylvania. I'm able to get those kiwi berries down to Boston for about $80 a pallet, but I could be shipping, you know, and it just works because of the truckers that I have the connections to. So I'm able to connect with the mushroom capital of the world there in Lancaster, PA, where there's tons of trucks running through there. There's luckily there's a mushroom house right next to the farm where we pick up the kiwis. So because there's a mushroom house there and the trucks out of Lancaster, Pennsylvania are going to pick up mushrooms at the mushroom house that's next to our grower, I'm able to jump on that load and working with the mushroom house and adding a pallet onto that load, having my farmer bring it over to that mushroom house and getting that product to Boston through the mushroom truckers. And so through those trucks, because they're already trucking in that direction, I'm able to save and make great efficiency on that product moving to Boston versus another location where say for Holtwood, Pennsylvania, where I'm picking up heirloom tomatoes. The only reason I have a truck going to that area is to pick up those heirloom tomatoes for me, and then I need to deliver those. So when you're having a truck go off its course, the more you have a trucker have to go off its course to pick up a LTL or less than a load shipment, then the more you're going to pay. So the key is to connect with the truck that's on course with your sourcing and your customer, and probably traveling or in the same area or delivering to the same customer, and traveling by your sourcing of product, which is where you get the best bang for your buck.
So in listening to what you were saying, Angel, Laura, what's exciting here in part is that you all at Red Tomato are a real business, and it's that piece that's often missing in what we keep thinking of as an alternative food industry. You're thinking of it as a mainstream food industry and really trying to figure out ways to get the product of small and medium-sized farmers to a larger group of consumers. This is a very serious business, and I think that's something that is almost unheard of in most parts of the country.
When I start looking for truckers and thinking about the best way to minimize the cost per unit for the produce or whatever we're shipping at that time, what I do is I start within the network. So I start looking at our customers, our vendors, those are the places, and our truckers for references or to see if they can make that connection for us. Usually with those places is where you have the most liability, and liability is very important when you're shipping less than a pallet load because you're a small portion of that truck. So usually when I'm working with these I start searching for trucks from the inside and work my way out. So I start working within the network, and then if I can't find a deal within the network, then I'm looking for references from within the network that will get me to somebody who's really liable, who can possibly and is possibly moving through those lanes before I go out further to a 3PL network, which is just it's kind of almost that's the higher level of risk taken when you're shipping less than a load shipments or consolidating.
And Michael, what you were trying
to
say,
I'm
sorry, Laura, go ahead. No, go ahead, please.
You know, you're right to point out the kind of the difference, whereas many organizations working on bringing local food out to consumers are trying to create an alternative system. One of the things that's unique and really exciting about Red Tomato is that we're trying to figure out how to make local food work within the existing system. And the work that Angel's done that's so brilliant is cultivating all of those relationships out there in the logistics and trucking world, because you get on the highway and there's no shortage of trucks on the road. We just, you know, need to know who to call, where the trucks are moving, how much space they have on them, so that we can maximize those opportunities and be ready to jump on an opportunity when a grower calls us and says, you know, I've got a great deal on this, or a customer calls us and says, we really need that. So very much it's about managing those relationships and trying to understand who we need to talk to help grease the skids to get the local food into that mainstream system.
And that's an important point, because one of the things I was thinking is, all three of you were just talking about this, is that I'm curious about how you all deal with the big food warehouses, Stop and Shop, Walmart, whatever you have up there, and what that's like in terms of getting products that, you know, if they're used to kind of buying all their apples from mass industrial apple farms in Washington State or Michigan, or strawberries just from California or wherever they may be coming from, what's their response to what you're trying to do, and how does that work both in terms of pricing and getting that stuff to those stores?
So I would say that we try very, very hard to make life as easy as possible for the big chains. And I put it that way because we may be bringing a large handful of growers that would take the place of one centralized packer shipper that they would be using. So we work really hard so that when our load shows up at their dock, it may have come from six different farms, but we want it to look like a unified, coherent, competitive load. That's what we try to do. And I want to just tell two short stories.
Please.
Well, actually, tell one and set one up.
All right.
Of how we do that. You asked the question about us being a business. We're actually a nonprofit. Incorporated that way,
uh-huh.
That is running a business. Everybody was working here because of their commitment to the mission, but we operate as a business. And one of the key secrets of ingredients here is the amount of cooperation in the grower network. So Angel made reference to giving up our warehouse back in 2002, and in place of all of those assets, refrigeration, warehouse space, loading space, and trucks, we created a decentralized network, and we consolidate and aggregate at farmers' locations using their infrastructure. And what makes this system tick is the amount of informal cooperation among all the growers who are participating in any particular deal or shipment. They're aggregating and consolidating and storing and loading trucks for one another, and we pass that responsibility around so that when we get to the warehouse, we have a professional load, pretty large in scale, that goes in as a consolidated load. I'm going to ask Laura to tell you the story about a program that we ran as a trial in New Jersey this year, because we, despite our efforts to make things easy for the distributors, we also have a way of asking them to do more and extra, because it's just inevitable when we're working so hard to differentiate a product and to make the farmer ID pass through. But we have this special program that really stretched the imagination and capacity of its participants.
Okay.
Laura, talk about you know what.
You know what. Because we're trying to service mainstream supermarkets where our end customer is the retailer, but we're most often working directly with their distributor, their warehouse, that ends up being our direct customer. Just like we were saying before, most often we're trying to make things as simple as possible and as uniform to the way other shipments are coming in. But then you think about the retail market and you think how hard retailers are trying to figure out how to make local food work and how to differentiate themselves under their competition. And sometimes that customer wants something different, wants a partner like Red Tomato to help them create something new. So we have such a partner in King's Supermarket in northern New Jersey, who we approached this past winter with a wild idea of creating a program with them where we delivered product to their grocery stores within 24 hours of harvest through their mainstream distribution warehouse. They're a 24-store chain, and as the VP of produce, floral, and seafood said, we're small enough to do something like this and big enough to make a difference. So it was a really exciting opportunity for Red Tomato to try and create something new and groundbreaking with the customer. And so needless to say, the folks at the warehouse, because of their commitment to the retailer, were entertaining Red Tomato as we were trying to figure out how to make this thing work, and offering some concessions like extending their receiving hours and working with us on refining our systems and making them less onerous. But we were quite literally harvesting very early in the morning in South Jersey, consolidating at an independent co-op down there, grower-owned co-op, working with an independent trucker to truck up to northern New Jersey, unpacking 12 pallets, rebuilding 24 pallets, shipping them out overnight, receiving them at the stores between midnight and 6 a.m. in the morning to be on the shelf for the first shoppers walking in the door that morning. This program was branded 24/7 for the King's store, and we were able to do deliveries to all 24 stores 4 days a week for about 4.5 to 5 months.
That was Laura Edwards Orr, Director of Resource Development at Red Tomato. And I'm Mark Steiner, and this is Soundbites on Delmarva. We have to take a very short break, but please don't go away. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Laura Edwards Orr, Angel Mendez, and Michael Rosin from the Red Tomato. Welcome back to Soundbites on Delmarva. I'm your host, Mark Steiner. Today we're talking about the work of Red Tomato. It's expanding our food system, making it possible for consumers who shop in our neighborhood supermarkets to buy sustainable and organic food. It's opening venues to our small farmers, allowing consumers to have a real choice. And we're speaking with Angel Mendez, Laura Edwards Orr, and Michael Rosin, who work at Red Tomato. This nonprofit business is a hub that connects wholesale growers to supermarkets and other retailers throughout the Northeast. And before we went to break, Laura Edwards Orr told us about a partnership Red Tomato has with King Supermarkets in northern New Jersey. They deliver fresh produce to King Supermarkets within 24 hours of harvest. And I asked how and if this model worked.
It did. I think all parties concerned would call it a success as a pilot, and mm-hmm. we have a lot of work to do to get our costs down, to make execution simpler, to create less headaches for the folks at the warehouse and for Angel downstairs. but it was a success in large part because of the commitment of the King Supermarket chain, was an excellent partner and really helped us figure out how to problem solve and keep it at the forefront of their priorities throughout the growing season. And the growers that supplied the product, these were the growers that, you know, we showed up on their farms and said, hey, we have this wild idea. And they said, I can do that. Sure. And it was the same at the co-op. The co-op was our aggregation partner, and every time we called with a challenge and said, you know, we need to harvest 2 hours earlier, we need this stuff cooled better, their answer was, we can figure out how to make this work. So there was a tremendous amount of goodwill and experimentation in all the partners to make it a success.
There was an early bump in the road in the whole program in logistics, but being that this program that we were putting so much importance and energy behind it, we had a plan B for logistics, and our plan A was that we were reaching the end consumer through a distributor who was backhauling the product and picking up the product at the co-op and getting it out to the distributors. And due to the constraints with the growers packing and stuff, the truck, the distributor had pulled out around the middle of the program. They pulled out their trucking, so we lost our backhaul option, which is the distributor's truck picking up our product on its way back home. When we lost our backhaul option, we had already we were lucky that we had already put a plan B in place and tested it. And so we were able to implement the plan B right away and continue the program without disruption.
So I hear you describing southern New Jersey and coming back north and selling throughout New Jersey. So how big is your area? How big an area do you cover?
Well, we're sourcing. We've got a cluster of growers. When I say a cluster, I'm referring to about anywhere from 2 to 5 growers in a specific area. So we've got a cluster of growers in the Vermont area, in the Massachusetts area, Connecticut area, New York area, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania.
That's huge.
But you bring up a good point there. Geography and definitions have been a point of curiosity for everybody who questions the local food movement. And our position all along, I think, which grows out of our distribution work, is that it takes a region to do this work, and that if we get too parochial about defining what local means, we are going to have a boutique food system providing a very small number of people some rather expensive food, and we're not going to be able to provide large volumes at reasonable prices to people where they shop. So for us, we're coming as New Englanders, the smallest states in the union here. We really need the production power of New York, Pennsylvania, New Jersey to do a good job servicing this region.
Michael, the point you make here, I think, is a critical point that we've heard debated on this program and around this whole world of new farming all the time, because it's the battle of what means local. And the argument about only, also adds to that, the argument about only eating seasonal. I mean, clearly your farmers can sell, you can aggregate this food and distribute it to large vendors on this regional scale, but that means you have to do it in season, correct? Obviously.
Yeah.
So
there are a couple of products. Here we are. It's November.
Right.
What do we all do now? All these organizations that are focusing on seasonal regional production, how do they stay alive economically? And, you know, for Red Tomato, about 58% of our sales are in apples, and apples can be stored throughout most of the winter and produce high-quality fruit. But we've got lots more creative work to do to generate other ways to supply products. And, you know, root vegetables is another one. Greenhouse production is another one. But you've put your finger right there on, I'd say, one of the greatest challenges for food hubs and for all of us focused on regional seasonal food.
But you also have this thing called OK Fair Trade, correct?
Well, OK USA is actually, Red Tomato owns 10% of this Fair Trade banana company. It's really an equal exchange project. And though we provide as much support at the board level as we can, it's not part of Red Tomato operations.
But you're part of it. I mean, you have a relationship with OK USA.
Yes.
So
we have a strong relationship and a strong commitment, and but we play it out at the board level.
So does that mean, though, that when we think about a system of the future, a system that can go beyond merely industrial agriculture to provide all of our food, that as many people some people might argue, you can't. People are not going to stop eating strawberries in December, or bananas,
correct,
but just not.
Yep.
So that has to be responded to as well.
Yes, I mean I think those of us who are working at the numbers cranking level and looking at what the vision here is 50 years out, are not imagining a region supplying 70, at least an eastern U.S. region, or specifically a northeastern U.S. region, providing 75 to 100% of its capacity. There's research showing now, and this is being done at multiple sites throughout our region, that we could probably reach 50% if an awful lot of things fell into place. Some of that having to do with people's consumption patterns shifting, not necessarily dramatically, but shifting in the direction of some seasonal food choices, but a lot of it having to do with more production of foods that we may have produced a lot of here but no longer do, and meat is one of the important ones on the list.
And you don't distribute meat at the moment, though, correct?
We don't. We are entirely fresh produce.
One of the issues I find that when I talk to when I talk to small grain farmers, grass farmers who raise the chickens and ducks and geese and cattle and pigs and sheep, is that they have a distribution problem, wherever I talk to them, and B, a slaughter problem to make it work. But the model you're talking about, in some ways, is transferable to that industry as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this
I think each sector of the food system has its own unique kind of challenges in terms of scaling up or gearing up. And when you look at processed or manufactured foods such as frozen or canned, you have to ask yourself, gee, this is an industry that left the Northeast. What could it possibly take to revive such an industry to scale to a point where it really mattered? Every conversation in the region that really looks toward the long-term vision absolutely picks up the meat slaughterhouse kind of infrastructure capacity question. And people are scratching their heads, but there are several people who are really working hard on long-term solutions there. And seeing that as a place where things could look very different in 50 years than they do now.
So just theoretically for a moment, and I'm going to move into some more concrete things that you're doing at Red Tomato. I mean, as you see a system in America that has the possibility of transforming, I mean, it's also, in many ways, people would argue, has room for lots of models. I mean, if you were people who go to a large supermarket chain, whether it's Shop and Save or Wegmans or whatever that might be, and you look down the aisle and you see strawberries. I'm sorry, I'm fixating on strawberries for some reason, but you look at strawberries. There's a section that says organic strawberries and a section that says regular strawberries. But whatever that model is, these are strawberries that are grown at larger scale farms in California or Mexico or some other place. That world's not going to end, but the world can change as the world you're describing can grow.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's an interaction between the two.
Yeah. And so what I think you're saying is, as we kind of region size the food system, what's it going to take? What can we imagine? In some ways, what's the work agenda for Red Tomato? I feel like it's very exciting to be working on this stuff right now. And I'd say everywhere in the country, people are bursting forth with experiments of new ways of distribution, new ways of connecting consumers and to farmers. And everybody is paying attention. Local food continues to be the number one or number two kind of hot issue in the food industry at this point. So everyone is paying attention. On the other hand, some of the battles or the hills we have to climb are pretty steep. At Red Tomato, one is to create longer, deeper supply chains so that when we approach a potential new customer, we have enough growers willing to come forward with enough supply. That one raised yet another question for us, which is about the climate and the weather in the eastern United States. It's very difficult to raise organic fruit at a supermarket scale in the eastern U.S., and that's because of the humidity and the resulting pests, which are insects and plant diseases. And so one of the things that we created about 7 years ago was a program called our Eco Fruit Program, which emerged as an Eco Apple program and then Eco Peach, and we're now working on Eco Berries. Trying to create a scientific protocol that would guide growers to raise what we think is the greenest ecologically grown fruit that you can do at a supermarket scale here. And that's part of region sizing the food system, finding ways to get fruit into the mix at large volumes. And there's a longer list, and I'd say one of the most important things are all the work that we do around logistics that Angel leads us on to make our loads and our distribution costs cost-effective and efficient.
It leads to some of the questions that what you just said, and I'll start with the one you just popped in my mind, an Angel. I think that people, the work you do, and I mean you've been with them since 2002. You started as a warehouse manager. Now you're a director of operations for Red Tomato, which is a huge job. I think that people, what you're describing and what Michael described and what you described earlier, is the complexity of the distribution operation, how critical it is to making a region-wide system work. And I think that's something that, you know, until you described it, I never really thought about. I mean, because for you it's constantly changing, isn't it? I mean, you're always having to come up with new models.
With everything is constantly changing. The connections. I mean, we could be selling the same product to different customers at different prices, and a lot of that is due to the pressures on the logistics.
And a couple of things were said here that I think that merit a little more exploration. And one is the use of the word that you've used, Michael, and Laura, you use the word echo. And you don't use the word organic, but you talk about the word echo in terms of your products. Talk about what that means. What does echo mean, Laura?
So the way Michael was describing, there are certain challenges in organic production in the Northeast because of our weather and pest pressures. So our eco fruit program is based around a protocol and philosophy of growing called Advanced Integrated Pest Management. So Integrated Pest Management, IPM, is widely used across the country of growers who are using various methods of pest control that kind of start with the most natural, least invasive methods possible and kind of move up the spectrum as pest pressures require. So they're monitoring and trapping insects in orchards, for example, to determine whether or not it can be managed, the pest problem can be managed naturally in a site-specific way, or whether or not a pesticide might need to be applied. Oftentimes, the first line of defense can be as simple as pruning or thinning or mowing or mulching or kind of very basic sustainable agriculture practices that growers have been using for generations and generations. What's challenging about IPM as a large concept is that it's very site-specific. Growers are managing their microclimate as needed. That's what makes it a flexible, useful tool. It also makes it challenging to communicate to consumers. So Red Tomato, in partnership with the Northeast IPM Center, actually developed a third-party certified growing protocol using advanced IPM for apples, then peaches, and we're working on berries right now to kind of create a growing protocol that is pushing the envelope as much as possible in terms of sustainable practices on the farm that still enable the growers to deliver a wholesale quality product at the volume needed for supermarkets.
I think in this debate in America about what we mean by healthy food and sustainable food and organic food, this idea that you all have come up with or partially come up with and wrestle with, which is the idea of an ecologically sustainable product that's different than organic food, clearly different than what's grown on conventional farms, is a really important concept, because in some ways it's like you're wrestling with reality that doesn't limit you in terms of who you can work with and what products you can use. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I think that getting an understanding of what that means is kind of critical to many people, because many people can't even deal with or address getting this kind of organic certification, but do want to grow food that is sustainable, healthy, and also healthy for the environment.
Yeah, and I think we work with organic growers. Those kiwi berries that Angel referred to earlier in Pennsylvania, those are certified organic. The message here is not that one way is better than the other, but when Laura talked about site specificity, it's that growers have to do what they can do where they are, and they should have choices on how to farm smart for some crops, organic is a great way to go. Organic growers use the IPM methods that Laura was talking about, and IPM growers overlap with practices with organic growers and have a lot to learn from organic growers. So this is kind of a hopefully to be seen as a green team effort in terms of moving agriculture in this direction.
And the other thing I was reading on your website, which is you include in this, is there's the work you do with scientists, with agricultural scientists from universities in different places to help develop these kind of eco-friendly ways of farming and to kind of help get away from organophosphates and the rest. So talk about that relationship. How does that fit into your nonprofit business?
We have a very strong partnership with the IPM Institute of North America. They're actually based in Madison, Wisconsin. But together with them, we have recruited scientists from University of Massachusetts in Amherst, from Cornell University, and increasingly from other universities in the Mid-Atlantic and New England states. It's like a three-legged stool. The way the ECO program develops and is managed is that the scientists work with the growers and write the practices, and it's in a form we call a protocol. Unlike organic, our protocol is constantly changing. Not a lot, but we are trying to raise the bar and respond to changes in climate so that once a year we get together, and the three-legged stool are the scientists, the growers, and the Red Tomato mission-driven staff, each representing a slightly different part of the accountability there. The scientists are using scientific information to make their recommendations and draw lines in the sand around different pesticides and pest management solutions. The growers, the ones who are going to implement this, are saying, we can do that. We might be able to do that. Let's call it a trial, an experiment, or we think that that puts the farm at risk. We can't do that. Red Tomato is saying, this is what we need to do for consumers, for our customers. This is what the chains are asking for. And we kind of debate it out. And every year come forward with as high and strong a protocol as we can for that year. So there's a real tension in the system that's a creative tension that really works for us. And this current climate is really challenging us. New insects emerging every year or two, and more rain and more humidity increasing the disease pressure.
So, I mean, there's so many questions in my mind. I only have like 5 or 6 minutes left with you all today anyway. So because this is such a model that I think that people have been really want to have a dialogue about and hear how it works. And I'm curious, one small thing, it's actually not so small, but I think it's important, when you sell a product, when you get the product out to stores, how do you deal with the question of what you use to keep the crop safe? I mean, if you're not going to use the pesticides, or is there a limit to pesticide use, restrictions to what you tell farmers you have to work with? I mean, how does that work for you all?
You know, you put it in the context of talking actually to the consumer or the shopper.
Right.
The advanced IPM protocols are, this is extremely complicated stuff to communicate simply. So we talk about stewardship on the farm, using nature, working with nature as much as possible before intervening with the use of a pesticide. So some of the ways to work with nature are by introducing natural parasites and predators that will control the pest, using mechanical measures like Laura was talking about, having to do with the way you care for trees or plants through pruning and spacing and trellising, things that introduce air, which is actually plays a role in disease control. And then there's things like scientific measurement. So if you can measure the amount of a problem before you decide to spray,
you have a chance to really limit and reduce the amount of the material before you put it on. And that's one of the basic principles in IPM, which is measure first and then react second. And then the last thing we do is the protocol says which materials are allowed, which materials are only allowed under certain conditions, and which materials are completely forbidden. And that's how a lot of the chemicals get actually eliminated from the game.
And going back to something we talked about earlier, Laura, the question of price and cost. I mean, I know that food is greatly undervalued and priced in America because the real costs don't ever hit the shelves. But how does it – and but consumers are very conscious, especially in this tight economy, over how much food costs to feed their family. How does that weigh into what you do, and how does it – and what's the – and what actually occurs – when the food's on the shelf in terms of pricing, comparing to other pricing?
So red tomato does come from a history of fair trade and the values around that. So a core piece of what we're trying to do is offer the growers in our network what we would call a dignity deal or the dignity price, which is often based on a conversation with the grower around the question, what price do you want for this product, below which you might lose your dignity, or what's going to feel good? That's a competitive market price for this product. So we're working with our growers on that level. We're working really hard to look at market prices and retail prices to understand what our competition is. But a lot of the magic in how we're able to stay competitive is in the work that Angel is doing in trying to master those LTL, less than a load shipments.
So I just want to say to the three of you, this has been a fantastic hour. I appreciate you taking the time with all of our listeners here on Soundbites on Delmarva. We're talking to Michael Rosine, Executive Director and Founder of the Red Tomato, Angel Mendez, who is the Director of Operations at Red Tomato, and Laura Edwards-Orr, who's Director of Resource Development at Red Tomato. Michael, Angel, and Laura, thank you so much for the time today.
It's a pleasure.
Pleasure.
The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites on Delmarva is a production of the Center for Emerging Media and made possible in part by the Town Creek Foundation. Our senior producer is Justin Levy. Our producers are Bobby Marvin Holmes, Stephanie Mavronis, and Mark Gunnery. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. For WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.